Let's begin. Good morning from New York, and welcome to NYIAC's annual Grand Central Forum. It is a means for our community to come together, especially important in these times. My name is Rekha Rangachari. I'm the executive director, and I am delighted that we are going to be discussing today the future of arbitration. What will the new normal look like for stakeholders in our practice? What are the ways we've each had to pivot to be resilient? And how will these changes have lasting effects on our practice, on the way we run hearings, on the way we run overall procedure? We really have an all-star lineup today. These folks need no introduction, but allow me brief affiliation introductions. Martin Gusey, our adept moderator, he is a partner at K&L Gates and a director at NYIAC, as well as serving on the program committee of NYIAC. Chan Bao, independent arbitrator and mediator at Arbitration Chambers, which has offices in Hong Kong, London, and New York. And last but not least, Christopher Lau, SC, senior counsel and chartered arbitrator at 3 Verulam Buildings. Both Chan and Christopher serve on our global advisory board. As a note, we hope that you'll stay tuned. This session runs from 9 to 10:30 hard stop Eastern Time. We also have sessions at 12 p.m. Eastern Time and 5 p.m. Eastern Time. If you'd like to tune in, registration is still available. Different lineup of speakers. We are remaining on the topic, the future of arbitration. Finally, two notes. If you'd like to raise any questions, we'd ask you to raise your hand, a feature within the Zoom. You see it at the bottom of your screen. When you raise your hand, our fabulous team at Foley Hoag will unmute you. Don't worry, your video will not automatically turn on, just unmuting. And then you can pose your question live to the group. We really want to make this interactive. The hope is that Martin and Chian and Christopher are not just talking to each other in a silo, but really having a conversation with you. If you prefer, you don't want to be unmuted, you can also posit your questions into the Q&A. But let's do this lively. Let's make this a forum. With that, I'm going to hand over the mic and the platform to Martin Gusey to take us in. Martin, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Rekha. Welcome, everyone. Good morning in New York, good evening in Singapore, Hong Kong, and good day anywhere on this earth. I'm especially honored to have Chian Bao and Christopher Lau with me here to address us today in a session that we would like to use to perhaps start drawing a line to look back at what happened ever since the pandemic has influenced each of our practices, whether as counsel, whether as arbitrator, or whether in an arbitral institution. We, of course, are truly New Yorkers with a forward-looking perspective. We do not only want to look back, we want to learn for the future and kick us off here in the morning, New York morning, 9 a.m., with this session, with a particular regional focus on Asia, which obviously you are already concluding from seeing my distinguished co-panelists. We will, as Rekha mentioned, have a midday session, midday New York. Daniel Schimmel is going to address similar topics from a European and Middle Eastern perspective. And Grant Hanisian will be moderating the afternoon evening panel, that again is afternoon evening New York time, with a focus on the Americas. We here, having prepared for this morning session, were unanimous in our conclusion that yes, while COVID will go away, its effects will stay. Those broad few words, of course, stand to be tested in detail, especially with the focus of today's discussion here. We have observed that tribunals do display enhanced procedural rigor. We are seeing more focus and efficiency, especially from cross-examinations. The decision makers, we think, tend to grow tired of COVID being used as an excuse for delays. That said, it cannot be excluded, It cannot be said that the pandemic has resulted in a significant uptick of settlements. And perhaps a fifth thesis for purposes of discussion today. Conversely, on occasion, cash flow constraints have influenced parties turning participating parties into non-participants. With these general remarks, I wanted to hand it over to Qianbao to start drilling in a little bit more deeply on the procedural conferences and oral arguments and give her the floor. Christopher will respond to Qian's remarks thereafter. I will engage in a moderated Q&A with our two panelists thereafter. That would be a great time for the audience also to raise their hands and for their microphones to be unmuted so that we can engage in a lively discussion. Thereafter, we'll do a second particular focus on the evidentiary hearings, starting in the reverse order there, with Christopher to start to give a presentation, followed by Qian to answer. And then the same procedure that we applied to the first topic block, I will start a moderated Q&A and encourage the audience also there to please raise their hands and for their microphones to be unmuted to chime in. Time permitting, we may address regional, cultural, and enforcement considerations. Of course, here should follow a geographical focus from the Asian American perspective. Christopher volunteered to start that block, again, time permitting, followed by Qian's responsive remarks and my moderation of a Q&A thereafter. Yeah, with that said, welcome. I shall step away from the microphone. And Qian, the floor is all yours. Please have at it.
Thank you very much, Martin. It's a real pleasure to be here with all of you today. This is the start or the second day of the Hong Kong Arbitration Week over in my side of the world. And so we've had some guests from New York do their evenings during our daytime. And now I'm doing vice versa. So it's a real pleasure to be here with all of you this morning, your time. Now, Martin has asked me to speak a bit about the procedural differences that we're seeing as a result of the pandemic. And I think that, in short, I think the areas of procedural change is where we will likely see the most sustainable change. Indeed, much of what we've seen in 2020 is not terribly innovative. Indeed, we have seen many of these procedural ideas afloat for decades. Indeed, I remember in 2000 writing an article about video conferencing. And I know there were many articles well before 2000 written by much more eminent individuals to discuss procedural techniques and video conferencing issues and the use of technology in general much more robustly than I was. And so here we are in the last several months, and we appear to be making leaps and bounds to catch up on past decades worth of ideas. I recently saw a meme that said, the decades that I have lived through are 1960, 1970, 1980, 1990, 2000, 2010, 2020, February 2020, March 2020, and on and on to date. So the last 6 months have felt like decades to some. And while it has taken us this long for the community to utilize these tools, it's a satisfying feeling that many of these procedural techniques that we are now finally implementing will be likely carried over as we transition into the new norm. Now let's take a look back and think about the last few months and consider some of the evolution of these procedural management techniques. Now, when the pandemic first broke in Asia in January and February, parties chose to adjourn cases in many instances. And this was particularly true with disputes, at least from my perspective, as between Asian parties and non-Asian parties. The reason, I suppose, being that the pandemic broke in Asia, but not elsewhere at that point, and there was no real understanding as to the circumstance. But as the pandemic continued to grow, and with less and less certainty and end in sight, adjournments continued, but then we started to see tribunals engage and parties seeking to continue on and press on with the arbitration. And with that, and I can't really identify a particular month, they seem all a blur at this point, but I would say it would be in the summer, early summer period that we started to see more and more engagement. And indeed, with the certainty of uncertainty, the tribunals began to reevaluate how to take arbitrations forward. And so with this, the first step was more procedural conferences, health check-ins. And in fact, the ease in which these health check-ins took place triggered more. And in fact, I think really what came to light was that how easy these regular health check-ins are, as well as the idea of just getting on video conferencing or connecting to resolve small procedural disputes seemed to be less of an issue than once initially thought. And so with this, we began to see more of this. And so now I think that there is now implemented in procedural order number ones, more engagement on regular health check-ins. Indeed, for myself, I will include these procedural conferences periodically to ensure that there are no major hiccups. And in fact, if you think about it and you analyze it with the difference between, you know, what doctors do when there is a health issue with their patient and what we do, there seems to be a lot of sense made in terms of checking in and ensuring that we can help resolve and engage the issue at hand or the impediment. And so this is kind of where we were in terms of seeing more procedural check-ins. And so herein not only did we have the procedural conferences, but then we started seeing more substantive procedural issues being dealt with midstream. And this is where institutions came into play as well. Many institutions put pen to paper and began to develop and engage with the community to give guidance as to the different procedural techniques that are available that already existed, but needed to be compiled to ensure that they were handy and user-friendly for not only the arbitrators, but also the parties. You will note that the ICC established a set of guidelines for measures aimed at mitigating the effects of the COVID pandemic. And in fact, there are specific procedural mechanisms that are suggested. And in fact, so bringing to light these types of issues, I think helps reignite the conversation about how bespoke we are as a system, as a process, and how we do have true flexibility to engage. And that is truly one of the advantages of arbitration. And this, we're finally seeing that exercised. So with that, I just wanted to kind of set the scene there, Martin, and maybe hand it back to you or Christopher.
Thank you so much, Jian. I think Christopher, if he could, should step up and respond to this
yes,
stage
of course.
Setting.
Of course.
Please go ahead, Christopher.
Thank you, Martin. No, I was going to add to begin with to what Jian said, which is that actually, holding procedural conferences and oral arguments remotely is not something that is too novel. I remember my first was almost 12 years ago with me sitting in Osaka in Japan, none other than Neil Kaplan sitting in Hong Kong, and the U.S. arbitrator in Los Angeles. That was my first. And so all COVID-19 has done is to bring, I think, into sharper focus how another way in which one can conduct or hold procedural conferences and oral arguments. Certainly in the arbitrations that I have been involved in, it is still acceptable for procedural conferences to be conducted by telephone conference. And in fact, where these are for no more than an hour and do not involve too many contentious issues, I think it is still the preferred route because telephone conferences are less distracting than a video conference. Further, you may have better chances with the telephone when the internet connections in a particular country or from a particular venue may not be too stable. So Mr. Bell's invention, I dare say, has still got some way to go yet. Now, I don't see why there should not be more midstream conferences held either by telephone conference or by video conference, particularly as by the time when we get to this stage, the issues would more or less have crystallized, but not to the point as to justify the costs of an in-person hearing. As for summary dispositions, the criteria I don't think would change whether these are in person or by video conference. And I think it is fair to say that even before COVID-19, as I said earlier, there was already a shift to having procedural meetings and oral arguments being conducted either by telephone or by video conference. And what COVID-19 has done is to widen the acceptance of remote hearings and providing greater comfort, I think, to tribunals that might have been concerned that if they did not have an in-person hearing, then their decision might be impugned down the road. By the same token, it has lessened to a significant extent parties and counsel's reluctance to forego an in-person hearing for fear that if they do not insist on or have an in-person hearing, they might lose out in one way or another. And in the case of counsel, the fear that the client might perceive them as not having been forceful enough on the client's case. This change in attitude, I think, is here to stay. And so that's I thought might be helpful.
Indeed, thank you so much, Christopher. Listening to the two of you, hear positive effects throughout. if you were both asked, what's the downside for the arbitral procedure, perhaps now and going forward, could you come up with an answer?
Yuqian, go ahead first.
No, I was just going to say that I think for myself, there is very little downside when you have an opportunity for real change. You know, I think that when we are able to travel again, we'll be able to incorporate some of these. We'll take some, we'll leave some, but at least we have more choice. And then we can be, we are then responsible as arbitrators, as counsel to our clients to utilize these options. And I think that that is something that will really move the dial in terms of cost and time efficiency, something that we've long been grappling with in our industry. And so this is that real opportunity. I wanted to kind of respond quickly to Christopher's preference for telephone. And I think that that was your preference, as I heard correctly. I have to say, I really struggle with telephone conferences because I don't know who's speaking all the time. And so I think there is something to be said about being able to visualize who's speaking and who's engaging and really understanding like how the how the dialogue flow is going when you have Zoom or some sort of a video conferencing facility. So I think having video conferencing as a default rather than resort to the alternative is a much better option.
I think one of the greatest developments we've seen, with this increase in remote hearings, is that it's led to a quantum leap in the use of technology. And what that has done is to bring out, as this morning's conference during the Hong Kong Arbitration Week showed, is the importance of cybersecurity, and that this cannot be emphasized enough. And this has been recognized, you know, in the number of cybersecurity protocols and recommendations that have emanated since. And this is probably an aspect, I think, which needs more attention as the phase of arbitration evolves.
I think there is a panoply of topics that already have been raised by both of you, and I'm trying to unpack maybe a front end, a tail end, even coming to the cybersecurity and perhaps other securities, and even down to the point of enforcement. It strikes me that the latter aspect, the enforcement of the award, is something that will likely still stand to be tested. Whereas I think the arbitral community, now going back from the tail end of the proceedings to the front end of the proceedings, it took a mere 6 months to address the current circumstances, show its enormous flexibility and its responsiveness, whether that is, you know, by means of counsel or by means of arbitrators directing the parties or institutions giving guidance. Now, I did raise my remarks here with the tail end of the proceedings, the enforcement side of things. Going to the very front end of it, I remember earlier discussions where arbitrators have reminded participants in the procedure to affirm the duty to cooperate as amongst each other and with the arbitral tribunal and anyone else involved in the arbitral proceedings. That, in, as such, strikes me as, from a common law perspective, the most natural thing. Everyone, at least in the U.S. context, is absolutely used in a contentious proceeding to work with your opposing counsel, especially on procedural measures. Courts have always enforced or enhanced this duty by means of early conferences and the parties attempting to agree in advance. It was somewhat surprising to be reminded about this at the beginning of the pandemic, that the parties should sign up for this yet again in their first procedural correspondence and or orders then rendered by the tribunals. Do you still see a need for an embrace of the duty to cooperate? And in particular, are there still international arbitration participants, perhaps from civil law systems, that are not as used to interact with their adversaries and their opposing counsel in procedural steps to be reminded about a duty to cooperate?
I think the need to remind parties to cooperate has always been there. And that hasn't changed with COVID-19. Even before COVID-19 came along, very frequently, it has been my experience that you can have counsel or parties on either side having to be reminded that for the arbitration to work for their benefit, they had to have some form of cooperation. What COVID-19 has done, I think, is to emphasize to them how important it is that they cooperate. I mean, to some extent, you know, it's also reflected in how much experience counsel have representing the parties appearing before you. Experienced counsel, I think, you find less difficulty with and counsel, you know, into their first arbitration or even from a civil law jurisdiction, if they've only had 3 or 4 arbitrations under their belts, might struggle sometimes, you know, with the thought that they would have to give up on something if meant, you know, they had to cooperate.
Thank you. Xian, do you have a reaction?
Yes. No, I was going to say, I think parties, we would hope that parties don't have to be reminded as to their duty to cooperate. And certainly we see this from time to time in procedural order number one. But I think that in there has recently been a study, or there is a consultation draft through ICCA on, you know, issues of civility between parties, and the fact that there is such a draft, or there is such a need for that kind of set of guidelines, indicate that that's the duty of to cooperate and in good faith, etc., is not necessarily taken earnestly by counsel equally around the world. And so I think there is indeed a need to continue reminding counsel. I also think that whilst I have seen a good bit of patience and understanding in times of COVID as to behavior, on the other hand, I also have seen counsel be more rude than normal. So I think it kind of cuts both ways as to the reaction of counsel in times of particular stress. And I think there is a lot behind what, you know, individuals are facing in their lives. And so it's very difficult to see how they might react. And so I think it is useful to have that reminder.
Let me try to tackle the issue from yet another perspective. Is a party's lack of faith, perhaps even both in the procedure and in particular in the arbitral tribunal, detrimental for the virtual process? Don't we need two or more parties that participate in an arbitration to have faith at least in the arbitral tribunal for all of this to work?
I think the short answer to that, Martin, is yes.
I'd say it is obviously, if that's there, then we can proceed. The question is, if you have some participant that doesn't, does holding procedures virtually make a difference to the in-person setting?
Is your question in relation to due process and if a party does not participate? Is that the question that you're going down?
I think that's the ultimate tail end of the consequence. If the faith is so little that, you know, the party is a non-participant, then the default setting is triggered, which obviously is addressed in most procedural set of rules, and allows the tribunal to proceed, yet having to assess the merits of the case and conduct the proceedings simply with the participating parties. That's more common than a moderator's question, I understand, Gian.
Well, I mean, yes, I think that a non-participating party, and I've had a situation where the party was participating at the outset, and due to finances, the party was no longer able to pay their counsel. And so whilst there was a live email at the end of, you know, receiving the documents, the parties were not able to, there was no engagement. And the consequence being significant care put into engaging and ensuring that the respondent had the full opportunity to, you know, engage in the process, but also at the same time, moving forward and pressing on with the process and with the virtuality of our proceedings. And so, yes, whilst there might not be participation, I think there is still a duty to press on, as provided that you give the opportunity to engage.
So in between the beginning of signs of lack of faith and a default by any party, it's for the tribunal to afford the opportunities to participate.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think it's for the party, but also the counsel who's pressing on with the case as well. I think it's certainly I mean, the ultimate conclusion is the enforceable award, as you were saying you would get to. And so I think that all of the different procedural decisions that are made along the way have to go to ensure that.
I mean, I think, you know, Martin, if I may say, the tribunal has to start on the basis that it has to earn the trust of the parties. They can't take it for, you know, the tribunal can't take it for granted that the parties has, you know, a party has faith in the tribunal. So, you know, I think the starting point needs to be that the tribunal has to earn the trust of the parties. There are all sorts of ways to do this. I mean, I've had one arbitration recently where the suggestion was made very early on because of COVID-19. COVID-19 was just coming on. And I made the suggestion that we should do it, to have a virtual hearing. There was great resistance to it from one party. But over the course of, by email, over the course of about 5 months, towards the end of that, which was about a month and a half ago, the party which showed the greatest reluctance then said, "I understand now, I accept it." You know, effectively, the decision was, I've got enough faith now in the tribunal to say I'm prepared to go with a virtual hearing. So really, you know, the tribunal has to earn the trust of the parties and, you know, somehow engender faith, you know, the parties trust in it.
Good morning to all of you. I wonder if the panelists would comment on the extent to which translation issues are further complicated by going to virtual hearings. I've had several cases where not only the key witnesses, but sometimes lead counsel are not fully comfortable presenting their positions in English and necessarily require translation. And it's difficult enough in an in-person hearing to deal with translations like that. But I find it just one more level of complication and awkwardness if you have to do it virtually. I wonder if you have any thoughts or experiences that might be helpful.
Well, I think you're quite right, Patrick. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, Martin.
I was about to suggest Daniel wanted to raise a question too. Maybe we can have his question posed as well and then address the two in a pair.
Sure. Good morning to all of you. My question was on a slightly different topic, but translations I feel are really important too. My question involved so-called Kaplan openings, which are oral arguments right after the submissions of the initial merit submissions, and an opportunity to have a dialogue with the tribunal on the relevant issues to maybe narrow them down or focus subsequent submissions. And they're very seldom used here in the US. I was wondering whether you've seen an increase of those types of Kaplan openings in Asia as a result of the pandemic, and whether you feel that they're useful, they add efficiency to the process, and if so, when. But again, I felt that the question about translation is really interesting, and I was curious to have your thoughts about that.
Thank you both. Christopher, you started answering. If you could go ahead, please, and sorry for having intervened there.
No, I think Patrick brings up a very important point. It is difficult with translation. Virtual hearings struggle, I think, when you have translation issues. And certainly in the arbitrations I've been involved in, where there are difficulties with translations, then we've always, you know, we've had to agree to have in-person hearings, and that has resulted in the hearings being rescheduled.
My personal experience on language and translation is such that I think when parties are well-resourced, that is, you can ensure that each side has multiple screens and the translation services are well networked as well, it's possible. I understand and appreciate the translation issues still can be awkward, but I think really the awkwardness comes not necessarily in the translation process itself, but rather in the cultural reading of the individual that isn't speaking English. And I think you lose a bit on screen versus in person when you have the person in two dimension who's not speaking the language you're familiar with. And I think that that creates the awkwardness. And so just being aware as to what is causing the awkwardness is the first step to kind of diffusing some of the issues associated with translation. Because I actually don't think it's translation that makes it awkward. I think it's the cultural reading of the individual and how they react to things, any delays and issues and responses that make it more, more kind of how you, what you're reading into, how much you're reading into those nuances that makes it difficult. Patrick, I don't know what your experience is. I mean, you've mentioned that it's awkward, but, you know, would you agree with my comment, or do you think it's do you think it's actually the translation?
I agree with you. I think a large part of it is cultural. If you're actually face to face with someone, including the translator, because frequently there's an awkwardness with the translator who you don't want to insult. I've had a number of cases, for example, with Chinese translators who are excellent translators but don't know the technical, legal, or trade terms that they're using. And they can lose tremendous face if it isn't handled properly. And that is all the more difficult if you're not actually in the same room with them, if you're just a voice out of the ether. So it's
well, I was going to say, Patrick, I mean, it's compounded sometimes when you have counsel themselves who are also fluent in the language, and they then take issue with the translation by the translator. And that is where you then find, you know, you have no choice sometimes but to have an in-person hearing. I had one recently.
I certainly agree.
Yeah.
The other compounded effect to that, of course, is, you know, I mean, speaking of in our region, Chinese comes in many dialects. And even if you're speaking Mandarin, your accent might be such that you can't even understand, you know, as a normal Mandarin speaker, the other person's accent. And so those nuances make it very tricky, I think, to kind of engage even in, if everybody is fluent in Chinese, but different dialects of Chinese, I think that you can have issues in micro translation issues as well.
I mean, I'm the son of an engineer. There may be others that have gone through these kind of dinners. Even if you speak the very same language, that doesn't mean you carry the same meaning with the particularly term chosen by maybe your father or the son responding to it from a legal perspective, in my case. What sparked my interest, Patrick, is you referenced counsel having language difficulties. Is this a moment where a tribunal needs to take extra steps to ensure an equal opportunity of representation and a party to be heard?
Well, again, you get awkward situations. I'm thinking of a particular case that was where the Chinese party was represented by Chinese counsel. And I seriously doubt the Chinese party was prepared to pay a big British or American or whatever law firm. And the Chinese counsel was actually quite good and quite effective, but his English was terrible. And it made the entire procedure quite awkward. In some of these today, in so many cases, arbitration counsel throughout Asia speak English better than I do. So it's not a practical issue, but it does come up.
And then maybe if we could take a moment on Daniel's question as well, the perhaps more frequent use of intermediary conferences and argument in different legal traditions than the American legal tradition. John and Christopher, do you have a comment on that?
I mean, I don't see, yes, sorry, Chen.
I was just going to say that I actually think it's a really good idea to front load a dispute and the resolution of a dispute. As we all know, once the client hires the counsel, they're already halfway into their dispute before the counsel arrives. And then, you know, 90 days later, the tribunal's constituted. And by that time, the dispute has continued. And so by the time the tribunal has access to the facts and the submissions at hand, the dispute has come quite a long way. And so for the tribunal to really get up to speed on what it needs at the outset to run an efficient arbitration, I think it's very helpful to have a Kaplan opening up front so that it not only assists the tribunal, but also helps the parties and their counsel get up to speed and really try to hone in their arguments up front before it gets too far down the line. So I have found it helpful. I'm trying to start front loading some of my arbitration so that I can have a better picture of it and manage it better.
I mean, to answer also another aspect of your question, Daniel, I've not seen a reduction in the number of cases where Kaplan openings are used and where the tribunal then uses that as an opportunity to have further discussions with counsel. And they do it remotely. There's been no reduction in the number of instances when that has happened, when one has to do it remotely.
I think this question, at least in my perspective, relates to, you know, the summary disposition idea known in the American civil procedure. And rather than having, you know, requests for awards surface in writing and the parties trying to set their stakes on individual legal positions, that you know, for instance, limitations of liability as such, which is often an attempt to surface in this context. I think the question is that I would pose is, are these intermediary procedural conferences attempts to get a read from the tribunal that then guides the party's understanding of what the outcome of the case may be?
I mean, I think it could be, certainly, and I don't think necessarily there's anything wrong with kind of getting a reading and getting a sense and making sure that, you know, you're going through the arguments in the direction that assists and supports the arbitrator in rendering their decision. But I think that summary dispositions, I mean, I personally have not seen them kind of exercised that robustly. I think that there is still that reluctance, although I do think it is helpful that the rules now expressly provide for them. And so I think that that's kind of helpful to kind of guide the parties and arbitrators in that regard. But I do think that it's something that is not necessarily one that is exercised. Yeah, I don't think it's exercised as much as it could be.
Christopher, do you have a comment?
Yes. No, I was going to say I've certainly had a number of applications, summary disposition applications. They've all been quite well argued, and you're right. It's an attempt to find out in some way how the tribunal thinks. They've not been successful so far.
Okay. In getting a read or in getting a disposition?
In getting a disposition.
Okay. I suggest, Mike Lampert wanted to raise a question. Maybe we take one more question, and then if we could address the evidentiary hearings, a topic I think that we have circled around from all perspectives, but I can't wait to hear on that also from you, Qian, and you, Christopher. Mike, could you speak up? Is it possible?
Sure. So can you hear me? Let's start with that.
We can. Yes, okay. Thank you.
So Christopher early on talked about cybersecurity and its importance. Earlier this week, The Guardian had a story indicating that online chess has become rife with cheating because each participant now can have a computer in their room when they're supposedly playing an online chess game or someone ranked more highly with them. When we were anticipating evidentiary and other hearings by video, there were questions of, is the witness going to have a screen demonstrating something or another person in the room? Has anybody heard whether there have been instances where panels have thought that witnesses are cheating in the way that seems now to be going on in chess by virtual hearings, by online hearings?
That's comforting to hear. Very comforting, actually, Christopher. there hasn't been any temporary wall falling to reveal whispering suggestions to a testifying witness that may have occurred in investor-state arbitrations before.
I mean, that said, I did have one hearing about a year ago where it involved a Central Asian state, and the witness was seen to be taking a little paperback, and counsel on the other side then, you know, objected and said, look, what is that? What is it that you've been given? And he opened it up and it was a packet of sandwiches. He was hungry.
This may be a cultural influence where the want of immediate availability of food differs from culture to culture, I think, and could be more important in one than another. But it's also comforting to hear, Christopher, that this wasn't a paper bag filled of notes of suggested testimony. This may be a great segue into addressing evidentiary hearings. Mike, do you have a reaction before I go on?
No, look, I've seen it occasionally happen in the real world, and I hadn't heard any reports of it happening since we've moved online. But given that The Guardian said that it apparently is now, several people have been disqualified for this happening in chess, it made me worry again, and Christopher raised the cybersecurity point, that if it might have happened that I hadn't heard about it, or that people may get complacent and stop watching for it, basically.
Yeah. Good. Thank you very much.
Martin, I noticed a comment in the chat box about Zoom function for simultaneous translation. Do you see that?
Indeed, David. Yes. Thank you, David. Zoom has functioned for simultaneous translation. Has anyone used that? Is the question.
Well, I haven't, so that's the quick answer, but I think that's a great segue into the use of AI. And I think translation is a great place where our industry could invest in better use of AI for simultaneous translation. I think a lot of efficiency could be improved by just having, with Google Translate and all these other kind of things that you see just at your fingertips for free now, I'm sure the simultaneous translation AI mechanism is quite sophisticated, and we may just not have tapped into it properly yet.
I haven't done it in the reading context, which this question, I think, suggests to be the major difference in the virtual setting. I think most of us have done bilingual proceedings in which, you know, you pick up the translator's earplug and listen to one or the other language, be this English, Spanish, or English, Mandarin, or any of these settings. My major difficulty is it tends to increase the number of participants and costs, and that's primarily because then reviewing the transcript, which is usually bilingual as well, leads to many contentions. I'm not sure if this is a question that truly relates to the virtual or the change to virtual hearings, but maybe Qian and Christopher, is this something you have observed too? Is there a preference to limit a proceeding to a single language by means of the official record?
No, I've not had that. I've not had that. Not, you know, for instance, with China, you do have dual language arbitrations. And as so far as I know, and Qian, you know, will correct me, there's been no attempt to try and limit it then to say, let's have this just in Mandarin or let's just have this in English.
I would agree that this virtual hearing situation has not kind of been the trigger to argue for, you know, creating a monolingual arbitration. I think that those kind of disputes have happened, have long happened. And so you either have a strong view on it or you don't, but it won't be because, you know, you're going online that you are now kind of arguing that it must be one language or the other, because oftentimes, of course, the contract deals with it. And if it doesn't deal with it, then there will be one indicator or another to for the tribunal to render, you know, a decision one way or the other that isn't as a result of the virtuality of the situation.
I don't want to miss the evidentiary hearing presentation parts following questioning and answering there. But Dave, if you can speak up by now, I mean, could we hear from you that not only have we addressed your question, or do you have additional comments there?
I just wanted to clarify, because I realized that what I said was not clear. And Martin, good morning to you. Qian, it's not AI. The Zoom function is not an AI function. It's not Zoom doing it. It's parties have to hire their own interpreters. And then Zoom has a function so that, similarly to any hearing where you have simultaneous translation, you could choose channel A for language A and channel B for language B. So it's not an AI function of Zoom. That would be unbelievable if they could do that. But I'm talking about what I just described. So you have the parties have to hire an interpreter. I know of it. I haven't yet used it. And that's why I want to know if anyone else has.
Yeah, no, thank you for the clarification, David. And actually, I mean, on that point, what I do think is useful to highlight is the fact that our technology is evolving so quickly now, and that the Zoom that we knew 6 months ago is not the Zoom that we know today. And in fact, you know, all that you can do to unpin your screens to create a hearing room setting now, and all the different things that you can do to manipulate the screen to get closer to the real thing, is incredible, and something that I think we should not discount the fact that, you know, virtual hearings will continue to improve and maybe as close as, and may address most of the issues that we've been discussing throughout by the time we come out of this.
Excellent. Thank you. More yet to be seen forward future positive outreach. Where are we on evidentiary hearings? Christopher, please feel uninterrupted by my rigorous questioning.
Well, let me begin, if I may, with a war story, since this is, we're talking about arbitration, and arbitration is full of war stories. Some years ago, I was sitting in an arbitration with an Asian seat, an Asian venue. It is fair to say the arbitration was not going well before the hearing, before the merits hearing, for one of the parties. And the fact that I was at that time then holding, for that case, ICC's record for the highest number of challenges, all of which I'm relieved to say fail, was the sure sign that trouble was on the horizon when I did get to the venue for the hearing. And sure enough, it did, because in the middle of the third day of the hearing, an attempt was made by the obviously very unhappy party to have me put in jail. Happily, that attempt also failed. And it's fair to say that that was an incentive, at least for me and for the tribunal, to conclude the hearing as quickly as we could, observing, of course, all due process, and then to forget about doing any sightseeing and to leave the country as quickly as one could, as soon as the hearing was concluded. Now, why did I give that war story? Because, if anything else, COVID-19 now provides the perfect explanation for having an evidentiary hearing by video conference, particularly when you think there's a risk that one party is up to no good and will try and do what it can to derail the process if you have an in-person hearing. But on a more serious note, video conferencing, of course, has accelerated paperless arbitrations, very much to the satisfaction, I think, of my personal assistant, as she now no longer has to find room for the storage of cartons and cartons of documents. And the change, I think, in institutional rules, such as in the recent revision to the LCIA rules, reflect this. I think it is fair also to say that this acceleration is global, with large parts of the community, wherever it might be, working remotely. Again, a change, I think, which is for the better and is here to stay. What about Zoom fatigue? Unfortunately, I think so is Zoom fatigue. So I'm afraid we will need to get used to it. But there is a benefit, I think, which is that it has resulted in counsel being more focused, tribunals being more rigorous on the use of time. And in the long run, I think this change in habit is likely to be carried over also into in-person hearings. I'm not so certain about asymmetrical hearings, where the tribunal effectively sits with one party at a time, with recordings, transcripts made available to the other side, followed then by shorter reply arguments with all counsel. There appears, at least in my experience, to be a general reluctance to adopt this procedure. Although I dare say, where the time difference is more than 12 hours, this might well be an incentive and, in fact, a reasonable way to proceed. As for whether certain kinds of fact and expert witnesses are better suited for video conferencing, I do not think the kind of fact and expert witnesses make a difference. I think the difficulty turns on how contentious the hearing is. I have conducted hot tubbing by video conference, and I know of many arbitrations where this has been done as well without any problems. Of course, if the hearing is extremely contentious and a ruling is required from the tribunal every few minutes, then video conferencing does have its limits. And these are certainly then cases where an in-person hearing is preferable. That's what I wanted to say on evidentiary hearings and video conferencing.
Thank you very much. Qian, would you like to respond?
Yes, thank you. I think evidentiary hearings, it seems to be where the general consensus is, where lines are drawn as to whether virtual hearings work or not. I hear quite a bit of reluctance on engaging with evidentiary hearings online. Now, I think that there is a lot to be said for, you know, getting as far as possible virtually, and indeed many arbitrations have taken place in this regard, in this format. I personally think that there is a lot more that we can explore in the way of technology to ensure that evidentiary hearings can also be conducted online. I'm very curious about this asymmetrical or asynchronous hearing kind of circumstance. I have not personally used it myself, but I think that there is a lot to be said about engaging in this way. to allow for time zones and for allow for parties to engage, you know, and have a little bit of lag time between submissions. I do have to also say that courts are doing it. And I have to think when we're talking about this particular area or this particular point in the hearing, it is useful to look at what courts are doing around the world, because many courts are quite progressive. And in fact, Singapore, I know, has a set of guidelines for asynchronous hearings. And so when the courts are doing it, it's hard to say that arbitration shouldn't be doing it, in my view, or at least there shouldn't be an option for, you know, parties to be tailoring their process to be able to engage more more flexibly. And so I think that whilst I know that there is reluctance with evidentiary hearings being conducted by remotely, I think that we should not be so kind of pessimistic or cynical about our options. I think there is Zoom fatigue, and the longer the hearings, the harder it is, and I appreciate that entirely. But then the question is, why are they long, and whether they can be kind of pieced up a bit so that, and staged. We were talking earlier about Kaplan openings and whether there can be more staging of hearings to allow for more time in between, so it isn't so onerous on the parties and all involved in arbitration. So I do think that there is opportunity to kind of explore deeply. And I appreciate that in this moment, when we have so many pressure points and the hearing is either on or off, this may not feel like the time to be creative or using that blank sheet of paper that everyone kind of references to, you know, try something out in the course of a live arbitration. But having said that, this is the time to force those issues when you feel like there's an opportunity, an appropriate opportunity to do so. So I think that, you know, I'm not ready to kind of close the door or rush back on a plane when we're able to, just because, you know, because it's harder. I think that as we evolve, and we're talking probably another 6 months to a year before we're able to kind of think about, I mean, this is all uncertain, but before we're even thinking about kind of getting on a plane for a hearing. So I'm optimistic that we will continue to see an evolution of our procedural, of how we handle the arbitration process.
This is truly fascinating. I love the emphasis on the idea of the asymmetric hearings. Let me ask the provocative question here. Hearings being argument on the one side and testimony on the other. Is this a plea to consider that argument may be more important for the decision making of arbitrators than the actual testimony?
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that. No, I think that it's part of the whole package. I'm not sure if I would kind of weigh one over the other in this regard.
I think we all agree. I mean, let me be more precise in my questioning. Obviously, the hearing involves all of it, and every case, you know, involves testimony unless it can be disposed of without going through, you know, examinations at hearings. I think we addressed that earlier on. That seems to be rare at best in terms of actual dispositions, but good for reads. What I'm after is this. I think the idea of doing asymmetric hearings primarily addresses the argument, counsel's argument, and may have been fueled by, in our setting here, you know, the reality of, you know, Singapore and Hong Kong being 12 hours ahead of the U.S. East Coast. Now, having said that, does this debate allow an inference, not a conclusion, but an inference that certain legal cultures may embrace argument as perhaps more important, based, of course, on the testimony, than the testimony to come out. Second question then following is, does such argument have to come in orally, or is it better placed in writing?
I think maybe Christopher, I'm not sure if I quite understand that question. So maybe Christopher, if you understand, you can have
it. Yes, I was just going to ask the same thing, Martin. I'm not quite sure what the question is.
Let me put it completely differently. How useful are contentious cross-examinations?
I think it is very useful. I mean, the whole purpose of cross-examination is to test the credibility of the testimony that's being preferred by one side. If you ask whether in the context of whether that can be conducted asymmetrically, I think on evidence, that might be, you know, insofar as evidence is concerned, that might be difficult. I had actually one in February where we where it was suggested we do it that way, but we decided not to, and so had hearings effectively in one Asian venue, and in 1 week, followed by a hearing on the West Coast of America the following week. Because whilst it was suggested by one party, I don't think it was forcefully suggested, and I don't think, you know, as the tribunal, you know, all three were not convinced this was the better way to go about it. I think if you have contentious cross-examination, to try and do it asymmetrically, it's difficult.
Yes, I mean, I would agree. I think and I would like to call it asynchronous hearings, because asymmetrical feels a little bit lopsided in my mind. So let's call it asynchronous, which where you have different timing. And I think for this particular part of the hearing, I would reserve for a live situation. But I do think there are many other aspects of the hearing that can be conducted asynchronously.
On perhaps, you know, fading out of the asynchronous idea, have you observed a different style of cross-examination throughout the last 6 months as compared to the way cross-examinations were conducted before?
I haven't seen it done differently. I do think that what's interesting is how it's done, and I think the way you use your screen when asking questions, and this is quite cosmetic in some ways, but I think cross-examination is a moment where the theatrics come out and there's more engagement and things. And so I think that there is a lot that can be done around maybe creating more protocols or guidance as to what that cross-examination situation might look like when you only have two screens and you have one person looking at, you know, in eye contact and all of that at asking, you know, the witness, and the witness, you know, where they're sitting, what you can see, like how close they are to the screen. I think all of those kind of aspects do become quite important, and there could be quite a bit done in terms of guidelines just around this aspect of the proceedings.
I was going to say, Martin, I was going to say that what I've certainly found is that counsel have become more focused in their cross-examination. And that's actually, and they've, you know, where they've agreed that, you know, the chess clock, they've always completed the cross-examinations well within that time. So in that sense, it's led to greater efficiency in cross-examination.
I'd like to pick up on Jian's idea of sometimes the mere logistics making, or perhaps being able to make a difference, which is in the current setting a document and a testifying witness can appear next to each other on a screen. In the past, it was difficult to look at the two pieces at the same time, because either there was a paper copy in front of you as an arbitrator, or there was a screen somewhere in the room that displayed the document. Isn't that a truly helpful function of the virtual setting?
The answer is yes.
Yes, I agree.
And now, flipping the coin, do you perceive to not be able to read the nonverbal communication from a witness in a different way these days when listening to their testimony on the screen?
I mean, that is one drawback of a virtual hearing. You know, it's often said that where the credibility of a witness is an issue, being able to see the whites of the eyes is so important. And in some cases it is, I think.
I would say that I think you gain some and you lose some when you're virtual versus live, because I do think that you can see the whites of people's eyes on screen, and you see them much more closely than you would if you were live. However, you're not seeing the entire body, right? And you're not seeing their interaction or their tics or anything that kind of might give different indications to you than just looking at, you know, the screen from a certain angle. And so I do think that you gain some and you lose some. So I do think you get a lot more out of facial expressions, because obviously when you have gallery view versus speaker view, you can see quite a bit, but you're not seeing what's around them. You're not seeing what they're referring to and their screens, unless you put different screens up. Again, I think there's a lot to be said about what you can do and when you're resourced. So if it's a well-resourced arbitration, I think you can get pretty close to what you need to get in terms of replacing the in-person. But when you're lacking resources, then it becomes much more limited as to what you can and can't access in terms of engagement with the individual.
Right. It's perhaps sometimes hard to see whether the witness feels the heat of the action by simply looking at his or her face. Now, I mean, extrapolating this from a single witness to multiple witnesses, which, you know, happens more often in the expert setting, although I'm careful to use the word more often here, I'm not sure how many times actually the hot tubbing idea of multiple experts taking the stand at the same time and being able to answer questions does happen. So it's a two-part question. Have you seen this being done frequently, or how often? And point two, has this been done in the virtual setting already in front of you?
I've seen it done, and I've seen it done in the virtual setting, and it's worked, but not with factual witnesses, with experts.
Yes, I have also seen it done. I do think it's helpful to have both on screen. And in fact, I think that there is something to be seen, like you said, about seeing individuals close up and in one space. So again, I think the psychology of that kind of connectivity does help in this circumstance. But I don't think it's necessarily better or worse than in person. So I wouldn't say it makes a huge difference either way.
I see. Excellent. Let me ask yet another question. Do you see more time being allocated proportionally to argument than testimony when the requests of the parties are made, how to structure the hearing on the merits.
No, I wouldn't say that I see more than the other. I think, I mean, at the moment, what I'm seeing, and this may change over time, is that there is more or less a, you know, replacement for the normal onto the virtual, or the normal in person into the virtual space. So I haven't seen a great difference in allocation, but I have seen a bit of abbreviation in terms of attempts to abbreviate the testimony section, but it doesn't always play out that way. And so I have also seen that, you know, it will end up taking longer because you need more breaks. So I think I'm not sure if I can say that there is a particular trend at the moment yet, from my perspective.
Yeah. Much the same for me. It's much the same for me, Martin.
I see. And in that context, then, is the concept of the virtual 1 hour a magic wand having changed the game? Is that because breaks tend to be scheduled after 60 minutes of a session in the virtual setting? And has that helped or not helped during the proceedings that took place in front of you?
It hasn't made a difference for me.
I think for me, it does help to some extent because it allows everybody to regroup. You know, I think that there can be, in a normal in-person situation, there can just be a natural flow of what's been prepared and just kind of continue on with little break. But I think with more punctuated circumstances, there is opportunity for counsel to regroup and even arbitrators to take stock. Even regardless of how short the breaks are, I do think that the more that the hearing is punctuated by breaks, the more helpful it is to kind of reevaluate. This may end up meaning reevaluating and extending it, so unfortunately, but I do think that it is helpful in any event.
I'd like to ask one more organizational question and then open it up for the audience and any questions, also aware of the fact that, you know, we've got about 8 minutes left only. On the organizational side, the question is, have you seen hybrid virtual hearings of certain participants being in one location and others being elsewhere, and then however the mix is conducted? And do you have any thoughts on something that has, you know, struck you as particularly helpful or not helpful in that context?
I've had a number of hybrid hearings. And the difficulty that's come out of it, I think, is it's really practical. Where I've had these hybrid hearings, they've been in Singapore. And in Singapore, in the room, everyone needs to wear a mask. So you have some before you physically. And it does, you know, it does make things difficult when counsel has to address you and he has his mask on. And the only time he can have the mask off is with a medical certificate. So in that sense, a hybrid hearing, you know, because of the rules that are in place, creates some difficulties because counsel find it difficult to express themselves well enough, having to do it with a mask on.
Yeah, I think hybrid hearings are actually a really good way to kind of move things forward to the extent possible. I have had hearings where counsel are in one room because they've kind of been isolated or self-isolated on their own, and in the same hearing center, the other counsel is in a different room. And then the tribunal might be kind of socially distanced, based in one room. And so while you're in the same hearing, center, you'll have arbitrations, or you'll have pods of people in different rooms. And that's one way of making it hybrid. And there are, of course, many others. I do think it's helpful to the extent that the tribunal can be together, but oftentimes that's the trickiest bit to kind of do remotely without being able to get the kind of engagement that you would normally be able to get. But even then, I think there are opportunities for the breakout room. Again, the Zoom or, you know, the systems are evolving so quickly that there are so many different ways in which you can engage despite not being in the same room. So I think hybrid is a good way to go, and I think we should continue exploring that.
This may be more a counsel's issue, but the interaction with your co-counsel and or client is something that truly benefits from, you know, presence in one room, even to the point of using your phone for a Zoom call, which is what I am doing, then having to switch to yet another phone, which may happen to be my wife's if it is available at that point in time, because we don't have a landline in the house. It is simple issues like this that sometimes, you know, had yet to be discovered in the stress setting that you know have made things difficult. I'd be happy to say that, you know, 6 months, you know, of doing this have passed, and, you know, these issues do not tend to present an issue anymore. Now, with that said, I am in a position where I think we have to allow a question or two if we can, if there are such, and if not, we would have to close our opening panel here for this NIAC Grand Central Forum. Let me ask into the round of attendees, are there any questions we could address before we close? I don't currently see any. We have been too informative on the issues we were able to address. Having said this, I would like to cordially thank you, Qian, and you, Christopher, for this truly enlightening set of perspectives on a whole lot of material. I think we left a little ground to cover for additional panels, certainly also on other geographical locations. I can't wait to go through the noon New York and 5 p.m. New York sessions to follow today on this Grand Central Forum. With that, thank you so much for not only having spoken here, but also for assisting NIAC's activities on the Global Advisory Board. It has been a true pleasure.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you. And goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Goodbye.